Lon to say a short prayer before we get started.
Okay, let's pray. Dear Lord, most gracious Creator, we thank you for all you've given us, all that we have to offer ourselves and our family and friends. But we ask you to teach us peace so that we may learn peace, so that we may know peace, so that we may live peace, so that we may learn and know the consequences of our lavish lifestyle. Be with us always, dear Lord. Strengthen us so that we can live without so much, so that we can live in peace and in harmony with the rest of creation. In Jesus' name we ask all these things. Amen.
Amen.
Roll the tape, Jonathan. My name is Jim McGrath. I'm the operations manager here at Holden. I arrived here in August. About a month or so ago, the village had a themed dinner, and it was a 60s love feast affair. And a couple of days prior to it, I began to get inklings of some of the things that were going to happen, and it kind of welled up a rather large knot in my stomach. Kind of like the one I get around Memorial Day or Veterans Day. And I decided to offer to anyone who wanted to listen my story about my time in the service during the Vietnam War. As I said, there isn't a script for speaking from my emotions. I'm just going to talk. I'll sweat a lot. I may pause some. Stick with me. I'll be back. The hope was, too, that this conversation would lead you and others in the room to talk about your feelings about conscientious objection and the church's role at this time that we're going through and other times that we've been through, and perhaps anybody who can speak directly about the Middle East and the effects it's having on them or their families. I have no other agenda for the meeting, so I'll just continue. You need to know a little bit about who I am. From the earliest, I was born in Erie, Pennsylvania. I was born to both Catholic, both French and Irish Catholic parents. My father was in the service at the time, stationed in Red Bank, New Jersey, learning radar and radar technician skills. My mother and I joined him shortly after my birth. And I was raised in New Jersey until I was 19 years old. I went to an all-white elementary school through eighth grade, and then went to an integrated school in high school. My father was an alcoholic. It was a pretty turbulent childhood. A lot of it I don't even remember. I graduated from high school in June of 1963 and did take on a full-time job, but at that time Vietnam was an item in the news, not as much as it was later on in the 60s, but it was an item. Young men my age who were not going to college really kind of got the message that we probably ought to think about joining the service. Actually, I first thought about joining the service when I was 17. My father and I had a great falling out over an incident that I had trouble I'd gotten into, having an accident with a friend's car, and alcohol was involved, and I spent a night in jail. And at the time, when you were 17, you could join the Navy under a program called the Kitty Cruise, but you needed your parents' permission. He was not about to give it to me. His goal for me in life was to graduate high school. He threatened me a lot with death if I didn't. I took that seriously, and I finally did achieve that. In March of 1964, about only just 3 days after my 19th birthday, I joined the United States Air Force. For those who don't know it at that time, and Jonathan referred to it earlier, I was carrying a draft card. This is the one I was given after I got out of the service as a 4A classification. I was a 1A then. Now I'm going to pass it around. This is what was burned later on in the later 60s. I joined the service, and I was in the metropolitan area of New York, and I arrived from Newark Airport in San Antonio, Texas, to go to basic training at Lackland Air Force Base with 150 other New York metropolitan area young men. And it was interesting, Wednesday night and Thursday night I spent at Lucerne, and I actually found some humor in some of this, so I'll try to relate that to you as well. I thought almost after getting in the bus that I had really jumped out of the frying pan and into the fire. We had, most groups down there had only one drill instructor. We, for some reason, had the privilege of having four. And if you ever know what it's like to have two grown men yelling at your ears, I'm amazed I'm not deaf. And they played real mind games with us. They really molded us to the way they wanted us to be in the 8 weeks we were there. Each of us had a little task to do in the barracks that we lived in. There was 50 of us. We were in competition with other barracks as of 50 other young men. And these drill instructors played the game very well. They found the weaknesses in you and tried to isolate you from the group so that the whole group's presentation was well. For example, David Harris is here. He'll know why. I couldn't march to save my life. I didn't know my left foot from my right. So when they came to competitions, they needed a minimum of 42 in the group to compete, and they would weed out eight of us. They'd put us on sick call, and they'd hide us out in the barracks. My strength for the group was that written tests were my strong point, and academically I did very well, so I was always at those testing routines. It was, again, we found out a lot of what they did to us as we were departing to go to other locations to mold our thinking, to have us be committed and loyal to this group. 2 days after we were there, one airman was hauled off in the middle of the night by the air police, and we were told it was because he had cursed out one of the drill instructors. Later on, we found out he admitted that he was gay and that they discharged him from the service, but we didn't know that for 8 weeks. They read our mail, and they used that against us all the time, publicly, as a group. But again, each of us did little teeny tasks. My responsibility, as I recall, was making sure that the knot on the duffel bag at the ends of everybody's bed was identical and perfect. I can assure you I know how to polish a floor with clear shoe polish and a brush. Little things that they found for you to do. Everybody had their own little place, and was an interesting psychology. I didn't realize it was going at the time. I do now, and it's fascinating. I spent 8 weeks in Texas in basic training. I had a civilian career as an architectural and engineering drafter, and that was a career choice I went into the service wanting as my first choice. In their infinite wisdom, they decided I should be an Air Force firefighter. So March, April, May of 64, I found myself on a bus headed for Greenville, Mississippi, to technical school to learn how to be an Air Force firefighter. I spent 16 weeks in Mississippi. If you recall, at the time, that was when the Civil Rights Act was passed, and that was also when the three Freedom Riders were killed. There were rumors about recruiting us to go and find them. As it turned out, they used Navy personnel from Baton Rouge to do the search. It was an interesting time. A northern kid who had not much exposure to integrated situations, being in the South, I befriended a young man who lived in Natchez, Mississippi. Greenville was in the north part of the state. Natchez was in the southern part. And 2 weekends, he and I hitchhiked to his home where I got a sense of a little bit of what it was like to be black. It was the first time I'd run into separated toilet rooms and restaurants. We were hitchhiking to town and got picked up by a friend in a truck, and then they picked up a couple of black youth who were great-grandsons of slaves from his family background. And his parental concern for their well-being was really very evident to me at that time. He was very concerned that they not get hurt or get in trouble. That's my recollection of that experience there. I graduated second in my class down at Greenville, and there was only one overseas assignment to Italy, and the guy who graduated first took that. I had first choice of stateside assignments, and I chose Payne Field in Everett, Washington, which is north of Seattle, now is the home of Boeing 747 manufacturing plant. And I arrived there in July of 64, August 64, and found out I had infectious mononucleosis, spent 30 days in infirmary, and was sent home to New Jersey for 30 days of convalescent leave. And I think this was the first time I really realized that death was a reality, Vietnam was a reality. While I was home, I stopped by a friend's house to see how two kids that I went to school with, 1 year older and 1 year younger, were doing. Both of them had joined the Marine Corps, and I arrived at the family home just after the Marines had been there to inform them that the youngest son had been killed by a sniper just outside of Tonsonet Air Base in Vietnam. And this was part of the pain that's left for me a little bit, in that not growing up in a healthy family, I went home with this news, and rather than getting a hug, my father handed me a beer. And it wasn't until 1985 I realized I had some tremendous healing to do as a result of not dealing with that death very well. In any event, I went back to Payne Field and began to do some duty in the fire department. They discovered my civilian career and cross-trained me out into engineering and architectural work, which I did for the rest of my service career. It became obvious to me in 1965 that most of the people I was at Payne Field with were headed overseas, and I found out that there was an opportunity to volunteer to go to Thailand as opposed to going to Vietnam. So I put in a voluntary statement to go to Thailand. I was married for the first time in February of 1966. By March, I had orders to go to Thailand. By July, I was on my way. Being in the Air Force was a bit of a safer career, at least as far as being exposed to violence. We did have some training at Travis Air Force Base when I departed to go to Thailand. The flight to Thailand was kind of interesting. We left California, hit Seattle, Anchorage, Tokyo, Manila, and then into Bangkok. This was a long flight. It was kind of an interesting route. I was stationed at Ubon Air Base in Thailand, which is about 300 miles northeast of Bangkok. There were several other bases in Thailand. Udorn, which was about 150 miles south of us, there was Nong Kampanan, which was called NKP, was about 90 miles north, Chiang Mai, which was towards the Burma border, and Utapao, which was on the, I guess you would call the Riviera of Southeast Asia, way to the south part of the country. Each base had a particular and different mission, and I'll try to describe those to you. Chiang Mai was mostly a recreational and rehabilitation center. Most people in the service who took R&Rs went there if they could. It served not much other purpose other than it was also a listening post with large listening devices because of its proximity to China, Burma, and North Vietnam. Nankampanan was mostly a helicopter base. It had temporary metal runways. It did have some small aircraft activity. Udorn to the south of us was F-105 fighters, which worked with ground troops in Laos and Cambodia. Utapau, which was where all the B-52s were at, that bombed Hanoi. The base I was at had multiple missions. We had F-4C fighter Phantom jets, which engaged MiGs over North Vietnam and over Hanoi. We also were headquarters for Air America, which was CIA operations in Cambodia, and Special Forces, who had operations in Laos. We also had contingents of British and Australian Air Force, as well as Thais. It was about 4,000 Americans at that base. I was in Thailand when we were officially not in Thailand. None of us were there. My ex-wife now only knew that I was in Southeast Asia, and I could not tell her where I was. My service, I spent a year and 4 days or so in Thailand, and my service career ended in July of 1987 in active duty. At that time, we served a 6-year total term, 4 years active, 2 years inactive. That kind of varied. I brought some other things from that time period. Everybody who went overseas and everybody who was in the service had a shot record. This is a record of all the shots I had while I was in the service. This form is Department of Defense Form 214. This tells you a lot about my service career in terms of when I served and where I served. I did receive a number of medals as a consequence of being there. It tells you some of my careers in the service as well. It was interesting. I was out of the service in 67. Most of the protesting was just beginning. Some folks have asked me how I felt about that, and I was really kind of numb about it. I really didn't know how to feel. I was trying to start a family and start a career, and I was really out very early. I do wish to make the point that I have been unable to talk about this until 1987, when I was discharged from the service. I was sworn to not speak about Thailand or my experience there for 20 years. And I indicated that I feel I have some healing to do. I didn't kill anybody. I didn't see anybody killed. We saw a lot of shot up planes. Most of the pilots who were shot down over Hanoi came from the base I was at. It was like those who saw the movie Top Gun saw the frenzy that exists on the deck of an aircraft carrier. It was very much like that where I was at. Very often, 24 hours a day on the flight line, planes constantly coming and going. Was kind of one of the funny things about there is we had a sniper off the end of our runway. He'd been there for about 18 months. And during my term, somebody spoke about this sniper, and I asked why they didn't go out and get him. And they said, no, they didn't want to do that because he hadn't hit anything yet. And they figured they might find somebody who has a good shot. So there was some humor in being there. Again, it's an emotional experience for me. The first time I really realized that I had a lot of healing to do was in 1985 when I was in Anchorage, Alaska, working for a firm there. The local veterans organization brought around a quarter-scale model of the Vietnam Wall. And I sought out the name of the young man whose family I went to see, and realized that I need to go to Washington, D.C. I have not been there. This T-shirt was a gift from a friend who had been there, to touch that name on the wall and to go to see the names, I'm sure, that my mother wrote me about, of other people who I've blanked out of my mind at this point. And I need to do some reconstructing of those memories and of those losses. I wanted to share one other thing that that I found interesting. It's Scott Peck's book, People of the Lie. And he talks about the My Lai incident. And I'll share with you a profile that he paints of young men of that time frame. The case of a prototypical individual may serve to illustrate some aspects of the relationship between American society in 1968, its military, and the subgroup of military fighting in Vietnam. Let us call this prototypical individual Larry and set the place of his origin in Iowa, the oldest of six children born in an alcoholic farmer family and to a tired wife. Larry was clearly a hellraiser from the time he had puberty. Dropping out of high school as soon as he turned 16 in 1965, Larry vaguely supported himself with a series of odd jobs and proved inadequate to pay for his car insurance, gas, and a heavy drinking lifestyle. In November 1966, he was apprehended attempting to rob a local gas station. The community was delighted to get rid of Larry, but at the same time had no desire to increase the state prison population or their tax burden. After all the money involved was recovered and no great harm had been done. So the country judge told Larry he had two choices, join the army or go to jail. And I'll add one other thing to that prototype that applied to me, as I was very classically an unchurched person. It's not a gory story, but it's mine. And I'll kind of open this up to some other folks.
Jim, when you were over in Thailand, how much were you informed about the status of the war and responses to it back here in the United States? Or how much information did you have?
Almost none. We had the Air Force Times, which obviously wasn't going to speak about anything like that. So I have no recollection of anything that was going on in the United States at that time.
Was there any general sense amongst those of you serving about the rightness or the wisdom of this war that you were engaged in?
Not that I was aware of. There were a few incidences of desertion at the base I was at. But my sense is no one was terribly alarmed that that was happening or even connected why it was happening.
When did you say that you came back to the United States?
July 1967.
Okay. And is it correct that you said that you felt, how did you feel about protests or newscasts showing students doing things? I mean, how did that make you feel personally?
I didn't feel offended by it. I was kind of intrigued by it. I had joined a local community service organization at a fairly young age, shortly after getting out of service, called the JCs, which some of you may be familiar with. And conversations with people in that organization, I felt somewhat supportive, although I didn't demonstrate or do anything overtly about it. I was sympathetic with some of the feelings that were going on in those later years, 68 and beyond. I didn't feel offended by them. But then I was not spit on either, as some vets were later.
And as a service person, I guess I'm trying to make a jump into where we are now. Either looking back or looking now, what do you think would be an effective way of communicating anti-war or non-violence thoughts or philosophies to people that are in the service? Did you feel like something like that could have spoken to you? Or was it was a career, it wasn't
I kind of think that war was more subtle. over a much longer period of time in which the entire country became a victim of it, not just the people who went there and did the things they did. This war, potential war, I think we can make a big difference by speaking very loudly now and as often as we can. It brought to mind a thought I shared with the folks a month ago on a news bulletin I heard on a Spokane news radio station about local children raising money for Christmas gifts for servicemen in the Middle East. And there was, again, the knot in my stomach, and it brought to mind my oldest daughter, who's 22 years old and going to graduate from college this coming winter, but 2 years ago was running into some difficulties herself and wanted to drop out of school and take a break and regroup. And she was getting a lot of pressure from her mom's side of the family to go back into school, and her mom was viewing it as a failure and suggested she join the service, to which at that time I begged her not to do, not knowing really why consciously, but now that I think about it, the underlying feelings of this is wrong really seem to be ingrained in me now.
You felt you were sold a bill of goods, brainwashed?
Yeah, definitely.
And the war was unjustified, as you look back on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one much more so, the potential one.
Do you see similarities between how you were encouraged to think about the North Vietnamese or the enemy in that situation and how we're being encouraged to think about our potential adversary in our conflict here?
Yeah.
What do you see?
The evil of the other side, the patriotic, democratic way is the only way. They're just not considering any other side of the coin. There's only one way that they're looking at this. And that's what we seem to be hearing. But I see a lot of belligerence right now in our government. At least at the presidential level and at the military level, which I would mostly expect.
Do you think the CIA, or is the CIA running covert action right now in Iraq and Iran?
I don't know. I wouldn't rule it out. The CIA was very heavily involved in Cambodia and in Laos both.
Could you describe a little the mindset of the military that you met?
Very macho, very gung-ho. The commandant of the wing at this base was a man by the name of Robin Olds, who's married to Hollywood actress, had been a Korean War ace, was actually told by Washington, D.C. not to fly during the Vietnam era, but did and became an ace again. The vice wing commander was Colonel, his name was Cappy James, the first black United States Air Force general, went on to become the commandant of the U.S. Air Force Academy. And both, it was just very, very gung-ho type of mentality. Very we're right and very they're wrong.
I thought it was interesting when you were describing some of the things that they would try to do to form you into a singular group, really against all the other little American groups. And it reminded me of two things, of scenes from, I think it was Top Gun, where they would pick out one person who was really weak, and might have also been from
Full Metal Jacket.
That's it. Those are very, very vivid scenes. But also of fraternity hazing, and of that mentality, and how it's kind of permeated mm-hmm. through the American culture of setting the groups against each other and of having the guinea pigs, having scapegoats, and the mind games to mold and to brainwash, and not being aware of the happening till you get beyond it and looking back. Because you're at that vulnerable point where you're at a point where you'll take it or receive it. I thought that was really interesting.
While I was there, an aircraft had an accident on the runway, and a 1,000-pound bomb went off and blew out half of one segment of the runway. They continued to operate around that while we tried to replace it. And you can well imagine being on a flight line with aircraft taking off within 50 feet of you. It's terrifying. But it's that kind of frenzy, that kind of mentality that it just keeps it going, and you don't question it, you just do it.
Jim, I think one of the biggest concerns for our age group definitely is the draft and potentially what that's about nowadays. Mm-hmm. And then conscientious objection. I've heard that you need to really prepare for that well in advance before the crisis occurs.
That's an area I don't know about, because when I was in and joined the service, that was a little talked about option. If someone else could speak to that, I really would feel more comfortable about conscious objection.
When I don't know a whole lot, but have some experience from social justice work I did while I was a student at St. Olaf, one of the things that students can do is go back and ask to write an opinion page for the Manitou Messenger, get something in print that states your anti-war status, get published in that way. I mean, if you're in a school setting, it's really easy to do that because it's pretty easy to get published in a school paper. That's one thing. Keeping files of anything, if you were to write a paper for a class, to keep copies of that, to collect anything like that. Those are all things that you can do.
Also, there was something I know my cousins did years ago, that if they had a counselor who they had talked to who had said, yes, I had a session with them and this is what we discussed, or professionals saying that this is what's been stated
before.
But I think the concern is how quickly this tension has come up and how hard it is. You can't plan for that, and if it's not on the front of your mind, now what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
There's a group called the Lutheran Peace Fellowship in Madison, Wisconsin, and your pastor should be able to put you in contact with that group, and they will support you. They will give you counseling if your family won't support you. They will tell you what you need to do. They will tell you so much. They'll even move you to a different area if that needs to be.
Jan?
Well, that was interesting. I just wanted to say that I have in the Resource Center information from Lutheran Peace Fellowship, a recent publication by the ELCA on conscientious objection, and the latest peace notes newspaper from the ELCA giving good lists of resources to write for, and a brochure from the National Association, I forget the exact initials, but anyway, it is a national organization that supports people seeking conscientious objection status. So come in at the Resource Center and I'll be glad to point those all out to you.
You seem to be saying, Jim, that it doesn't make any sense. This war makes less sense than the last sense. I wonder if that's a universal opinion here. This war doesn't make sense. I mean, we are almost assuming that in our direction of our thought.
War doesn't make sense. It's what the goals, you know, it flabbergasts me that the same stuff comes out each time. We have to protect the American way, which is marginal at times. The one thing I wanted to point out, if anyone has read the paper that came in, there's some unique things that have happened in this particular episode. Whereas the last, in the Vietnam War, there was a great deal of student protest nationwide. Everyone knows that. This year, it's being called apathetic, the student involvement. The last time there was, in the Vietnam War, and I don't know if you may be able to speak to this, but there, as I recall, there was little or no protest from family members of people in the service until a certain point when there was POWs and missing in action people. Now there's a lot of protest from family members of people in the service. So I think some things are changing, but one thing, it's the paper also said it's a 50-50 split as to, you know, pro and anti. The House of Representatives probably will vote to authorize, but the Senate it's questionable whether they can get that authorization. So we'll see what happens with that.
The parental protest would be understandable considering that this happened to me 27 mm-hmm. years ago, and if I had a child that age, it almost seems understandable that there's much more parental protest. I just read an article about recruiters having great difficulty, which is good, in my opinion.
I've got 214 in my safe deposit box, and I'll keep it the rest of my life. Mm-hmm.
214B.
And DD 214.
Discharge period.
I can't even talk about it. I wish that I could let the young people here know how much that paper means to me.
And talking about Al, what you said, I think if I were a president who was having some domestic trouble, this war makes perfect sense. Because it gets, for the same reason fraternities start little competitions with each other. So you aren't so sure that you like these people you're around, but you're sure you hate them. Mm-hmm. And after a while, you can convince yourself that because you hate them, you must like us. And it seems like this war, I feel real jerked around by the talk about it coming from the people who are controlling it, saying we're over there against this madman, this demon. He's not a madman, he's not a demon, he's a very calculating power monger. So is George. But what's getting me is that he can't, first that we were there to, what was the first reason we were there?
Protect the American way.
Protect the American way in Kuwait. Then we're there to, the next thing it was, well, that's not a good enough reason, so we better tell the American people that we're over there to save jobs. And then the next thing we better do is to go over there. What was the next reason?
The next Hitler.
Oh, yeah, well, the madman. That was pretty early on. We don't want to get this madman out of there. And it felt to me like this is a wonderful way to unify the country against this common enemy, take our mind off the savings and loan thing, which is going to cost each of us somewhere between $2,000 and $5,000 in our lifetime.
It's going to cost $500,000.
Yeah. And, you know, the money we're spending on this thing. Anyway, so it makes perfect sense from that particular standpoint, and that really pisses me off.
To speak again to that, Al, it does make perfect sense, and I believe that even if a dictator like Saddam Hussein hadn't aggressively moved into Kuwait, sooner or later in the next decade, our country would have sent troops into the Middle East to secure oil fields because of the supply of oil running out. And with that military superiority and our lifestyle the way it is, we would have gone in to secure those anyway. That's what I believe. And this is a very convenient way for us to be there.
John?
I was thinking about when we made the earlier comment about the student protests, about the parents. Kurt and I went to a protest in Seattle back at the end of November. We were there.
I drove by that, by the way.
You what?
I drove by that.
Oh, did you? Oh, okay.
Is that Gasworks County? Yeah.
That was downtown and Pike's Place, yeah. Yeah, right. And it went all the way around. But it's interesting, the people that ran the protest said that there were, what, 4,000 to 5,000 people there? Mm-hmm. And then we watched the news that night that said there were 1,200. Mm-hmm. Now,
always that way.
Who do you want to believe? But I would say, if the newspapers are saying it's apathetic, I would say I don't trust the newspapers.
Seattle's a pretty extraordinary city for that, though, too. There's a lot of noise there that isn't being mirrored in India.
Yeah, but at the same time, we were watching the news, they said Seattle, and then on the national news, they gave little blips to, you know, all over the country, you know, Boston and several other major cities. I kind of look at it in the way that the media isn't going to want to report that, but if they report even some, obviously there's probably a little more going on than what they're reporting.
There was an editorial the next day that somebody had counted the people in one of the pictures, and there were 700 people in the picture.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, I mean, the number was way off. The newspaper didn't respond to that, but of course not taking the time to actually count.
I was also going to make a comment about this whole thing with the parents. Does anybody remember this Army commercial that was going around about 4 years ago, where it was a radio commercial, I think. The guy's riding the bus home and he's thinking, boy, I hope Dad understands, you know. I had to join the Army. And I was at college a couple of years ago. We had this ex-CIA guy who was there. He was pointing out all these things. He said, yeah, the new G.I. Joe fighter bomber looks a lot like the stealth bomber. And, these radio commercials are saying, don't trust your parents, even though they lived during the 60s and know what's going on. No, don't trust them. Join the Army anyway. You know, so I just... I don't trust the government very much. I don't trust the media very much. So, in a way, that gives me some hope.
I guess I can't. This doesn't surprise me at all that we're on the edge of a war. If you think about what we've been doing in the United States. And what by our silence or just apathy that we've been a part of. I mean, we've been part of the biggest military buildup in the history. I mean, you build the toys, you're going to use them. And I can't believe, you know, that this is just happening, that Saddam Hussein just all of a sudden decided. I mean, we've had, what, two major invasions. We invaded Panama. There's still 1,500 people homeless. Places were destroyed. The U.S. hasn't spent a dime to try and rebuild that place. We've invaded it 13 times since 18-something. We're going to use those toys. And, I mean, I sort of feel like, why haven't we been saying something for the last 10 years? I think one of the reasons why is because it worked for us. It was part of something that we thought we were buying, economic stability. We were sold a package of goods for the last 10 years. And
Vietnam didn't work. Why don't we know that history? Vietnam didn't work, did it?
No.
Well, you know, when did we start hearing about Vietnam? At the most, it was,
85.
What? Yeah, 5 years ago. I was going to say, you know, what was it? What was that movie? Platoon. I mean, the government's been... Nobody wants to talk about it. The government doesn't want to talk about it. When did they get the memorial built? That wasn't very long ago either. You know, people have been. And how long were you under oath not to say anything? 20 years.
Till 1987.
I mean, they've been covering it up pretty well.
Well, the people in the intelligence in World War II, the Americans, have been sworn to secrecy for their entire lives. The British and French and so on have been able to tell their story after they started telling about 15 years ago. So about 25 or 30.
I have one small suggestion for the question about conscientious objection for students. I don't know how great of a suggestion it is, but it is one small thing, and that's the phone tax. I don't know, have you heard about the phone tax, the federal phone tax? It was established to support the Vietnam War, and the phone companies have no authority to collect it if you don't pay it. But you do need to say why it's not paid and why you're doing it. And you do establish yourself for withholding tax for conscientious objection by doing that. The IRS knows you're doing it, and they know the records come on down, and so you're on record for actually making some kind of conscientious move that way. It's very easy to do.
Is that a federal excise tax?
Yes.
What is that?
Yeah, it's a federal excise tax on your long distance.
So it's not your local access?
Well, I think, I'll back up, and I think it's all federal excise.
It's a U.S. tax, 3%. It was my last phone bill that I did that with. And it's the U.S. 3% tax that's listed on your bill.
That tax did start as a result of Vietnam. Hmm.
It'd only be like $1.26 or 46 cents depending on the size of your phone.
Yeah.
So it's not at all amazing, but I did it while
so they keep carrying that on your bill?
I wrote on a little postcard and included it with my check. And all you have to do is I cannot in good conscience pay the federal tax because it was a direct war tax, and I will not pay that. And for 4 years, I haven't paid a phone bill for a while, but when I was at Sinulf, I did it all 4 years and never got any.
Yeah.
They don't try and collect from you, they can't.
The only trick the phone company will do is on your next bill or next few billings, they will carry it as a charge that you haven't paid, and they won't tell you that it's the tax. You have to kind of keep some cuff notes and not pay. I did it all through the Vietnam era when I was in college. We've been doing it for years and years and years. But they keep track. Someday
do they keep it on your bill? It's still on your bill.
No, every 3 months the phone bill gives up. They don't want to mess with it, so they'll clear it.
Yeah, I went down and talked to them, and they're real understanding.
Oh yeah, they don't.
They said
they won't bug you at all. They
I explained the situation. Said that's fine. We'll just take it off and no problem.
Well, one other.
But wait, they needed the records.
But every time you submit the bill, it's kind of a pain. Every month, you need to put the card in. Thing to do is make up a nice card, Xerox a bunch of copies, flip it out, sign it.
Then do you keep that on record for yourself, or?
Well, we have. We should have. The other thing to do is, we also do income tax stuff, but you should, the other thing to do is over years is set a little side across an escrow account. So if they do, all of a sudden lean on you. But
I mean, as
we
far
haven't
as
done that.
To record a conscientious objector step, to say I have not been paying my tax, this means, this is part of my proof that I've been objecting, what do you
document that way.
Your phone bill could also show that they credited it off every 3 months.
One other subject I was hoping that someone could speak to from my perspective, and I seem at a great loss about it, is the church's role in where we are now and where we were in the Vietnam situation, and all wars for that matter. And Al had agreed to be here to maybe speak to that, but anybody else who has some perspective on that, that might be helpful to me at least.
One thing I think you can do in your own church to bring it to the surface is to talk about the just war. Just war. Doctrine. Which I believe the Lutheran Church subscribes to. And in discussing that, it should bring to the surface as to whether we should be going to war or not.
Well, I think the church should be a sanctuary for all kinds of things. And we've had two Guatemalan families in our church that we've supported illegally. That is, they are not registered, and it's very interesting because one of them just agreed to get married. They've been with us 4 years, and we didn't even know their right names, and so they had to come out now and give their right names because we're trying to get sanctions. We're really trying to get political asylum for them with legal help, but we thought they were a danger, and it seems to me that if the church can come to an agreement, that's the problem, of course. If the church can come to an agreement that something is sufficiently illegal or sufficiently against God's will to warrant that kind of decision, whether or not you get a majority of the church at least agrees to be that kind of a sanctuary. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit difficult of a process. I mean, you got to work it through the church. We worked on this, I suppose, for 4 years before we had somebody in sanctuary. We worked on Central American issues. So our church was knew what was going on. And if you were going to do this, it seems to me you would have to do quite a bit of educating of people as to what's going on in this war. And we read Halberstam's book on the best and the brightest from Vietnam, which clearly points out how everybody was bamboozled by the government, the whole thing was a setup. It was a manufactured incident in the Gulf of Tonkin. It was not an incident that took place. It was manufactured. And you'd have to, you know, if I were doing it, I would take that best and the brightest, and I would have a class in my church, and I would get people aware of the kind of thing they're up against with our government and the CIA and the lying that went on to all of us. And everybody, well, almost everybody was fooled. So I can't see any point to this war whatsoever.
One of the things that newspaper article also pointed out in Seattle, there was a church that traditionally would not protest, and that was a Baptist church in Seattle, was protesting this. So I think that's significant. I don't know how quickly or how powerfully mainline church bodies will say. They may say something, but I don't know how.
You seem to be asking the question of us of why we think that so. I had a class on the Vietnam War and saw some really interesting footage from different things, and especially the movie Hearts and Minds, the lasting impression on me. And the one thing that really impressed me was how everyone was kind of lulled into, don't bother me, I want to be happy, and that it was so far removed from them. And I think that as far as the kinds of people that I grew up with, that are regular churchgoers, are the kind of people that will be convinced easily and will say, okay, it's in God's hand, and they'll say a prayer for our nation's leaders, but that's as far as it goes. They won't see that power of God in themselves and in each other. And I think there's just that loss of identification and also already being convinced and lulled into a kind of nice safety net that leaves people very passive and inactive, and that it's the unusual church, an individual church body, as opposed to the main church that will make a statement. You know, you can find examples of individual churches that will speak up, but as far as the whole sect of the church, I think it's pretty rare.
I guess I ask that in kind of a way that says, where were you, God, when I needed you? And I look to the church somewhat to that, and that's kind of how I'm asking the question. There's probably not an easy answer to that.
And also the close association sometimes between, even though it's supposedly separate, government and church. And that was a real big example in World War II of Vatican just sitting on their hands and kind of having a behind-the-scenes deal with Hitler almost, and just not speaking up when they could have been very powerful.
Yeah.
Not realizing that.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me like we
the reality is that we, like Tom mentioned earlier, you know, where were we when all this stuff was going on? We can't just live like the kings and queens of this society and not pay a price. I mean, you're going to live like this, and then when it's time to fight for the stuff that you've collected over all these years, you don't want to fight. You know, it's either got to be one or the other. It seems like we have to give up our way of living and find a reasonable way to live and not eat up most of the world's resources, or we have to be willing to live this way and fight every 10, 15 years to maintain it. You know, it seems like to me, if the church should do anything, the church should be about what the church claims to be about, which is helping the poor, but also making people who, you say people have been lulled into this. I don't think people have been lulled into anything. I think people know exactly what happens when you go against the government. I mean, our newspapers are full of people who are either dead or crazy because they went against the government in the 60s, you know. Everybody knows that. So it seems to me that the church should be about teaching people to live on less and educating people, like Al said, about what we have done, which connects with what Tom said, and you know, not to just give it up, you know, when the war is over, give it up and let another Reagan come in and sit back and live off the fat of the land. I mean, there's a price to be paid for living off the fat of the land.
Until 6 months ago, until the Middle East thing came along, Congress was not going to enforce the continued mileage increases required by the federal government for new cars. Until 6 months ago, until we had another crisis. I mean, how quickly we forget that, you know, that we're dependent, that this whole, we don't have a history. There's no history here, and we're losing it.
I think another consideration regarding the church's role was pointed out by Gerhard Ferdy in one of his books, when he talks about the fact that the churches enjoy a very favored status, and we don't pay taxes, we don't have property tax, we don't have federal income tax, you know, there are just many, many areas where we have a very favored status. And after, or at the beginning of World War II, when there was a lot of hue and cry that was being raised in America, and again at the beginning of Vietnam, I believe it was, or perhaps it was a Korean War, when some of the churches began to actively speak out as to whether or not America should become involved in these wars, that was the same time that a great deal of attention was paid to our favorable tax status, and whether or not that was appropriate, and whether or not we should reconsider separation of church and state, etc. In other words, the club that was held over the head of the organized churches was that of losing that favored tax status if, in fact, you did become the conscience for the politicians. So I don't know how much carryover there is at this point, but, you know, we've got billions of dollars of investments. ELCA, all of the national churches. I'd like to think that we're not influenced by that, but realistically, of course, we are.
Let's talk about the, you ever talk to many people about the pastor's pension fund?
Yeah.
And
the divestment.
Divestment issues. I was going to, along those lines, I remember back in college, I used to get the magazine Sojourners, which is sort of also like the other side of Christian-oriented magazine that's very active in issues of South Africa, Central America. I remember one time on the a letter or on the editor's comment page, how they got a letter from the IRS that said, "Well, we're reviewing your nonprofit organizational stance, since we don't know if you really are." This was very recent. This was came kind of on the heels of some big article they had on Central America. It was kind of interesting.
So what do we do about Kuwait? We, I think a lot of times we think that since we here at Holden Village are against the government, that everyone else who is against the government is our friend. And I don't think that Saddam Hussein is our friend. What do we do about Kuwait? What do we do about the people who are dying there, the Kuwaitis?
What happened to sanctions? I mean, it's interesting how when we have somebody like the USSR who invades Afghanistan, we throw sanctions on them for 5 years, and you know, we didn't send any troops to Pakistan. We funded the resistance in Afghanistan, but you know, we were going to stick to the sanctions. But then all of a sudden, sanctions don't work in South Africa because sanctions, they just don't work. And then, of course, there were sanctions against Iraq, and we kind of followed. We had a couple destroyers follow the super tankers around, kind of scare them a little bit. And yes, we were going to enforce the sanctions, but now, ever since the UN has voted military force, no one hears much about sanctions anymore.
Military action is much more fun, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Well, where were we hearing about how effective the sanctions were? Who was reading something about that in the last couple days? I remember hearing something about the sanctions they're having in astronomically.
It was on the radio. CBC
had that's
broadcast
right.
out.
We were hearing
it. They're reducing their rations to about 50%.
Yeah, it was talking about the sanctions are having a tremendous impact on Iraq. Most of their factories are shutting down. They're running out of food left and right. And something like 95% of the sanctions, or 90% of the goods are not getting through because of the blockade and the sanctions. So, but we don't hear much about that on the radio either, or TV or newspaper.
It was a senator in Congress who was
That's
giving
right.
that speech.
That's
and right after that speech, they broadcast a speech by a Republican senator who supported the administration, who essentially said, that's all fine and good, but we've got a president who has made a commitment to using military force in the Middle East, and how is this going to play into Hussein's hands by all of a sudden creating a divided United States where the Congress is fighting?
All of a sudden.
All of a sudden.
The president.
We weren't divided before.
No.
I know what you're saying.
You're misinterpreting my words.
Oh.
Sorry, I used the wrong words. But
that is what they've been saying.
I mean, this has to do with bigger than that, though. It has to do with kind of, why don't we have a policy for the Middle East? I mean, we support Iran, and we support Iraq, and we're always supporting whoever we can support so that we can maintain our lifestyle. And until we take a stand, whether that's Holden Village, whether that's your congregation, whether that's you personally, until we take a stand and start to live more simply, it's going to stay that way. I mean, we are causing this, and we need to take some responsibility for that. We have not signed a nuclear non-aggression pact in the Middle East, and there's been numerous times because we want to supply Israel with the ability to blow each other off the map. I mean, it's our fault. We're here. We're here because we haven't had a policy in the Middle East that's ever been... We basically support the regimes. We're doing it in Central America, we're doing it in the Middle East, we're doing it everywhere to maintain a lifestyle for this society. And say what you want, do what you want, but until we come to terms with that, we are going to have to either fight the wars, Vermont said it perfectly, fight the wars to maintain it or to live more simply. And that means every one of you in here. And that means me. And I don't know how that answers for me, and it scares the living shit out of me. Because I have to go back out of Holden Village, and I have to find a job that doesn't connect to that larger group. into that larger, and I have to figure out how to live more simply in a, whether I'm running a college dorm or whatever, I need to start to take those steps. And I guess that's the challenge that I see happening here, if we make it. And I think that's a real possibility, that we don't make it past this step, that this is the big step that we're gonna take. You know, how are you all gonna do it? A lot of you are from St. Olaf are graduating in the next year or two or three. I mean, what does that mean? If your desire is to go out and to be the consumer, then you're for it. Then we're all for it. And if my desire is to go out and get a job with controlled data or Honeywell or for that fact, anybody. I mean, where I'm trying to consume and live a lifestyle that is not sustainable, then I'm contributing to it. That's the plan.
Well, I think there's another force at work here besides our greed for oil, and that's that war is a very profitable business. Mm-hmm. And we've lost our boogeyman, we've lost our enemy. Now the Eastern Bloc is, they're friendly. They're no more an enemy. We can't spend our money. The Republicans can't make money by selling guns to the people or, you know, the West Germans. So we need a new enemy, and this is a perfect opportunity.
Pentagon
for
has the third largest budget of any of all the countries in the world. The Pentagon has the third largest budget, $300 billion.
So we have all these Republicans making a profit off war, and we vote them in.
I'm sorry, but this makes me feel hopelessly crushed. I mean, I can live a simple lifestyle. Yeah, I can write letters. But hell, I'm 24. I just got out of college. What do I have to do with this? I feel completely powerless. And I would imagine a lot of other people do. So, I mean, yeah, I can do that, but that's just shoring up hope after hope in someone up there changing. I mean, that's like hoping that George Bush gets struck by lightning in a dream or something. I mean, I don't know.
We can hope.
Not in real life, because then we never
do. just a perspective on that, as you said that, you're 24 years old, and I says, I'm 45. God, if at 24 I at least knew that I was helpless. I didn't even know that I was helpless.
Do you think that's a better position?
Yeah, you know there's a problem. No, it doesn't make it any easier, I don't think. But you know. And that's real encouraging.
I don't think most people, before the 60s, most people voted for government. Not until after the 60s did cynicism creep in and people begin, like Jonathan said, not to believe most of what the government says.
Mm-hmm. And that's
when you think about that, when you think about the fact that now most people don't trust the government, that is a step. I mean, before the 60s, everyone trusted the government.
One of the problems of being at home is you can't even go out and protest. You could go out and protest, but you can't protest. At least if you were out there, you could march occasionally.
One of the things I remember about the 60s, and others of you whose memories are good, please corroborate this if it's correct. One of the most powerful forces at that time were the college students, who time after time changed their parents' minds about the war. I think that at that time that until the young people protested and kept at it and kept doing it, their parents thought that students were not right about it. And over again, I remember parents coming around because of the influence of their children and coming to disagree with the government about the war.
I think it's going to have to be the opposite way this time almost. I think of statistics like 20 years ago, 80% of the surveyed students said the reason they were going to college was to improve society, and 20% said it was to make money. Now it's exactly the opposite. Now, 30% of the students at Luther College are business majors, and I'm not particularly picking on one particular major, but business majors, accountants, I mean, a lot of people are in there to make money. So I think we have to be careful.
Well, yeah, but
as
when you,
students.
When you think about the 60s, though, the people who were going to school in the 60s grew up in the 50s. So
yeah.
The 50s was kind of a shame here.
Yeah, leave it to me.
Well, when the war breaks, when and if it breaks, I think you're going to see stuff in people that you never saw before. And Joseph Campbell has this thing, he doesn't have it. Mythology has it, where you thank God for your enemies. You know, and I think right now we're kind of a wimpy, gutless, jellyfish kind of a nation. And when the war breaks out and fathers, sons, brothers, sisters, whatever, don't come back or come back in a body bag or in a wheelchair or something to that effect, then we see what we're made of. And I'm not looking forward to that. But the reality of it is that that's the stuff that seems to move our nation. I mean, that's the stuff that seems to make us get up and fight. I mean, all the other informational stuff beforehand doesn't seem to be enough to motivate us.
I'd like to step to the hopeless thing in some of the people saying that that's good. I don't agree with that statement. If you're going to get involved in conscientious objection and trying to make some constructive changes, you need to feel empowered, not hopeless. Because you cannot, from a hopeless base, work. And continually work year after year at it. And that's one thing, I guess, if you look at churches in oppressed countries, and if you look at the history of where the base of this religion came from, it comes out of oppression. And the reason why people try to put a religion down is because it empowers people. So you have to find a source of empowerment. Gandhi was fantastic at empowering people. Helpless, starving people. And what did they do? They gave the British a good rotten time of it. So hopelessness, yes, but you got to get over that.
It feels also, too, like the church not only is a place to generate social action, find other people who are like you, but there also has to be the real presence of grace and love, even to, like you say, what would you just say, Roland, about thanking God for your enemies? There are people within little communities who we consider, who I consider enemies, and I'm grateful for them. I'm happy that they're there. And that's hard. But to me, that's the real dilemma of the church. We want to turn the church into, I guess I'm uncomfortable with this saying, Republicans are benefiting from this, Republicans are making that. The government is not to be trusted by anyone. Those kinds of things bother me because I think that's real blanket thinking. And I don't want the church to become just a social action movement. I don't want people just to be angry at this thing and they want this thing gone. But the church is also there to remind people of what it is we can have instead. And that starts between me and one other person. And here's what that feels like to get along with this person that way. Here's another way to deal with the world. Okay? Instead of just saying, this sucks, we can say, this sucks, this is what I want. And the church has to be able to do both, I think.
To quickly jump in and join Ken's thinking, to Jeff's thinking.
Thank you. I was about to do it if you didn't.
I've been in Central America for the past 3 months living there. And in El Salvador, one of the things I constantly heard from the people I talked to was, we're constructing the kingdom. That's what we're doing. And these are people I stayed for 4 days with a group of refugees who had walked from Honduras back into El Salvador, probably around 200 kilometers, to the place where they're living now. And they had started from absolutely nothing on barren hillsides in FMLN control, which is the rebel group in El Salvador, in FMLN controlled territory, with fighting going on all around them. And these 800 people decided that they didn't want to do it alone anymore. They wanted to be together, and they built their community. And after 1 year, I was there on the first anniversary, they they had started building a kingdom, and they were empowered. Even after being oppressed directly, this community was directly oppressed and directly harassed by the government, and it seemed like all the powers that be were against them. And yet they had hope, and they had this idea that they were constructing a kingdom, and that was their empowerment. And their community was their empowerment. They drew strength from that. And so I guess if you feel crushed with hope, don't be crushed until you're absolutely crushed. Don't be crushed until you're physically crushed.
Another good source of, we just thrown this out and go say, that all sounds nice and easy and good. A good place to start to test this out in history is Sharpe's volume one of his book, Politics and Nonviolent Action. It's a very thin volume. The other two are more encyclopedic. In that thin volume, it's entitled Power and Struggle. If you don't come away from that feeling empowered, you know, you might not read too well, but it really talks about, not in theological terms, it talks about it in terms of political realities. And it's an excellent, excellent work. And it's very empowering. And the big thing is fear. The other thing that was said over there that I totally agree with is being against something is all right. But if you want to work for change, you have to be for something. You have to say, what we're doing is not good, but you need to come up with an alternative. It's better to work towards. The protest against nuclear power went down the tubes, but it didn't speak to an alternative. It should have grabbed solar power and ran with it. And I believe, you know, anyway, without going further with that. But an alternative, what is, we verged on this a minute, a while ago in the conversation, what is our alternative to violence? Jonathan said the sanctions. That's only scratching the surface on possible political nonviolence. And it was given just surface treatment. I really believe Iraq could have been brought to its knees without military action. Japan was ready to surrender in World War II as a result of a boycott. They offered to surrender on one condition, that they leave the Japanese emperor in place.
And they got that condition anyway.
They got that condition anyway, but we dropped the bomb to prove it.
Yeah.
Well, we dropped the bomb to keep the Russians out. I had to do more communism than the Japanese. But the point is, the blockade was working. There are a ton of sanctions. Okay, you can do economic sanctions. I just, when this all came up and I was thinking that very thought to myself, what are more alternatives to this thing? I took the second volume of Sharpe, because I had read that, and flip through the index and say, okay, what are some of the different techniques? Jamming communications. You can go on and on and on, but the nonviolent thing takes a stronger and smarter person than somebody that jumps to violence, because you then have to understand fiber of social structure. And if you want to make a change, then you work it on doing that fiber. You don't work at trying to use violence and then sitting down later and figuring violence and does the fiber, but there's other ways to do it. Like jamming communications, blockades. There was one other I can't remember. But there are ways. But we have not gone beyond the thinking of violence as a solution to problems. We are so crude in that. We've spent years studying violence. We haven't studied nonviolence. That's an alternative. And it's out there.
Scott.
One of my hopes is that as a community of, I have great hope in a community of moral reflection. I remember in the Vietnam era when people went around the country and they said to us, you don't have to sign up and you don't have to go. And I remember what a radical thought that was. I hadn't considered that. And I remember standing in this rally and this chap who was, I think, student body president at Stanford at the time, very articulate speaker, saying, If you all out there decide not to go, then this war is over. And that was really a radical thought to me. I mean, it may sound stupid now, but I mean, in the 1960s, if you were raised in a home where that was not an option, that was a pretty radical thought. I remember what powerful kinds of myths were operative in our society at that time. The society was absolutely convinced about the domino theory. If we didn't defend Vietnam, then all of Southeast Asia, and a month later, the shores of Australia would be invaded by Russia. And give no mind to the fact that the Russian and Chinese couldn't get along with each other, and that was kind of a new point. And so I asked myself now, I said, what are the myths operative now that have gotten us into this struggle? Seems to me one of them is that somehow as a nation we've convinced ourselves that we're the ones that have to solve this problem. We're the only ones that can solve this problem. We're the ones that have to provide the leadership to solve this problem. That we're the ones that have to call the shots. That's about what we've got to do. And it would be interesting to think about what are the other kind of powerful myths that have led us. Every soldier that I've heard interviewed on the TV says, we're hoping for a diplomatic solution, but we're ready to fight if called upon. How do we get ourselves into that kind of position? What has led us to that kind of place? And I think as a community, one of the things we can do is to begin to think about what, and many of you have talked about some of those forces that move our society. And it's amazing what can happen if we say it doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to go sign up for this. You can sign up for some other things, but you don't have to sign up for this. I have some hope in that I don't know what happened. Wasn't the vote today? I don't know if anybody heard.
No.
I think Bush is going to have a hard time getting the approval of Congress.
You got it.
For both the Senate and the House?
For both. The Senate was 47-52 floor, and the House was a much wider spread.
Yeah, the House was expected to go. Yeah. Well, I tend to be optimistic. in Vietnam, it would have been, 90 to 20?
Since we're talking about the Vietnam era, I'd just like to use that as an example of empowerment. Who would have thought that all this government and things that we're so hopelessly enslaved to would be forced to start reconsidering its position by college students?
Mm-hmm. Johnson didn't even run the next time.
Right. Who stopped it?
Yeah.
Not big power players, folks.
I think we have to really have discussions of what in the dickens could we be fighting for? I mean, what could we be fighting for? What's worth fighting for? I just don't see that there's anything worth fighting for there, except to protect our economic system.
Which would probably survive anyway.
Big pardon? And I don't see that that's worth protecting.
Absolutely.
The way it is now, the way it works now.
First, did you read Time Magazine, three, 4 weeks ago, and they had that huge article on what a wonderful country Kuwait was?
Petrodollars.
There's a song, a line from a song by the Oyster Band that's been in my head that came to mind, Mary, when you were talking, and it's what to do as an individual, and the line is, work like you were living in the early days of a better nation. Work like you were living in the early days of a better nation. And I've kind of taken that as my credo. I'm trying to be very intentional about all the stuff that I'm doing and always remembering I'm dealing with other people, not other objects, and it makes it a lot harder to jerk them around. I can jerk around an object, but I can't do much with Kirsten.
I'm
going to say just one more thing, and I'll shut up. Yes, I think I'll promise to do that. As we keep talking about this, what I hear a lot of people saying is one of the keys is to live as though you were living the new kingdom building the new kingdom. I haven't read this book yet, but I went to a lot of sessions this summer, and a lot of the new theologians, new books out, are saying that's exactly what Jesus was saying. He was saying, you know, this government, this military dictatorship that we're living under, it has no real power. Live the way that God wants you to live. You know, I've come to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, which a lot of historians are saying this means the Jubilee way of life, which was one of the old ways that the Hebrew society used to work. Forgiving debts, starting again. Jesus, it seems to me, was saying, you are living the kingdom right now.
If there's a consensus, maybe we could end the session. Maybe it's worth continuing at a later time. There's a movie scheduled for 9 o'clock, and some folks might want to go to a snack bar. I realize this is an important subject. That's why I want to open the option to maybe go into this some more next week. Okay. We'll see what we can arrange on the planning meeting.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.